call this meeting of the House Finance Committee to order and let the record reflect that the time is currently 1:33 p.m. on Wednesday, March 6th, 2019. Present today, we have Representative Knopp, Representative LeBon, Representative Tilton, Representative Carpenter, Vice Chair Johnston, Co-Chair Wilson, Representative Ortiz, I believe you are online, is that correct?
I'm online, Mr. Chairman.
Great, thank you. Representative Sullivan Leonard and Representative Josephson, Representative Merrick, and myself, Co-Chair Foster. And as we start, just a reminder, if folks could mute their cell phones. Today's presentation, let's see, I think we've got everybody here. We'll include the economic impact analysis of the governor's proposed fiscal plan by Ed King, chief economist for the Department of Revenue, and the potential economic impacts of policy changes and employment trends by economist Dan Robinson from the Department of Labor and Workforce Development. So we will begin with Mr. Robinson on the potential economic impacts of policy changes and employment trends. Mr. Robinson, if you could go ahead and put yourself on the record and proceed with your testimony, and thank you for being here.
Thank you, Chair Foster. My name is Dan Robinson. I'm the research chief of the Research Analysis Section at the Department of Labor and Workforce Development. If you're not familiar with research analysis, we produce many of the economic statistics that you see in lots of places, including our publications on our website. But if it's employment, if it's wages, if it's if it's wage rates, unemployment rates, population migration, that most likely originated with us. We work with our federal statistical partners, primarily the Bureau of Labor Statistics, but also the U.S. Census Bureau to produce the data. We have different levels of control over the data, but even when we don't have much control, when I say control, the feds make some of the rules for how the data are produced. But even when we don't have a lot of control, we still have a lot of familiarity. So that's our expertise, really, is understanding the details of the data. We then publish it, and I specifically put up our last three issues of Alaska Economic Trends. That's where most of our analysis comes in of the data. We try to make it accessible to smart non-specialists. So we're not writing for each other. We're not writing for university economists, PhD-level economists, or other groups. We want it to be useful and understandable, and I hope that some of you are readers. I hope that all of you are readers. But. So to start off, I wanted to take a long view of Alaska's history. To orient ourselves a little bit here, you see the blue bars represent natural increase, and that's just births minus deaths. And you can see over that entire post-World War II history to the present, that's been a steady positive. You see in the 80s that it was a bigger positive. We had a younger population, more of a higher percentage of our population of childbearing years, and we get more natural increase. As you can see, in the more recent period, it starts to get a little smaller. Our population, our average age is getting higher. The orange bars represent net migration change. So that's not the number of people who came to Alaska. That's the number of people who came to Alaska minus the number of people who left Alaska. So that's the net number. Aside from that, the point I wanted to make with this slide is that there are three themes here. One is that the military has had a huge impact on Alaska's past, its present, and its future. We're not going to talk a lot about the future, but past and present, and there's no reason to expect it won't continue to have a huge presence on Alaska's economy and our population. The second theme you see here is that oil and gas has had an outsized impact on big migration flows. Obviously, what comes with that is economic growth and occasionally some give back when we're done with the pipeline, although the better example would be oil bust, when oil really juiced our economy. We got a little too hot. Things fell apart a little bit, and we had some negative years in the 80s. The final theme is that our interaction, our the relationship between our economy, Alaska's economy, and the U.S. economy has some influence on migration flows. So we've labeled the U.S. Great Recession as one example where we had migration gains, net migration gains, because our economy was better than the U.S. economy. That affected the migration flows. And then more recently, our current downturn, our recession, well, the U.S. economy has been quite strong over that period. So that creates some consistent growth there. So our primary use to you really is not in telling the future. We do forecast employment, and we'll talk a little bit more about that towards the end of the presentation. But we primarily give you a hopefully very good reading of what's happening now and what's happened in our recent history, and ideally what some of the things that are driving those changes, those trends. That gets a little bit harder because there are always lots of things happening in an economy, and it sounds easy to say, you know, what's the impact of this? But because there are always so many things happening, it isn't easy. But here's our up to the present. Here's our recent history. As many of you probably are aware, in late 2015, we started losing jobs. The oil price plunge precipitated this. Here we are, 39 plus months out, and we're still with our most recent data losing jobs. The losses are relatively minor in recent, really since the summer of 2018. I keep thinking, okay, we're gonna pop above zero and start growing again, but we're not there yet.
I'd also like to note we were joined at the very beginning of the meeting by Representative Thompson. Thank you for joining us. And we've got a question from Representative Sylvan Leonard.
Through the chair, Mr. Robinson, thank you for coming to present. Would you give us just a hint of what jobs are still at a loss at this juncture?
I'd be glad to. Through the chair, Representative Sylvan Leonard, a handful, and we'll look specifically at a slide later. It might be better to wait, but a couple of things I'll just mention now. Oil is starting to grow again, not by a lot. Construction is up, not by a lot yet. Healthcare has grown through this whole period. It never stopped growing. So those are the big ones. But then there are a handful of sectors that the titles wouldn't tell you a lot about them that are also starting to grow. So a year ago, almost all of them, healthcare excepted, were not growing. Now it's more of a mix.
Representative Knott.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. So I'm gonna show my ignorance here a little bit on the graph, okay? I need you to explain to me the graph in the sense, so you take a look between 16 and 17, so we'll call it 2016 in 6 months, and you're at your peak of job losses. But then, so is that chart reflecting every quarter? What's it looking like, all the bars in there?
Through the chair, Representative Knopf, that's monthly data compared to the same month year ago. So the very first red bar is October 2015. That means in October 2015, we had whatever that is, 700 fewer jobs than we had October 2014.
So the chart shows we had 8,400 job losses there in that month. Right, 8,400 fewer jobs.
Correct.
Down there at the peak. But then a month later, we're showing we gained, well, say 2,400 jobs, or we had less job loss. So they're not cumulative job losses, is my point, but you don't show any job growth on the top end of that. You recovered 2,400 in there. So that's what I'm trying to figure out, the chart.
Correct. Well, and through the chair, Representative Knopf, Alaska's economy, as you probably know, is very seasonal. So these kinds of comparisons in other states would tend to be made with seasonally adjusted data, which makes it slightly easier. It's difficult to seasonally adjust Alaska's data, so we tend to do this same month, previous year, look back. But as long as the bars are red, we are continuing to lose jobs compared to a year ago. So the losses can get smaller, but that's not the same thing as growth.
So it's really a year-to-year comparison from prior months is what that is.
Correct.
Okay, thank you.
This is the almost everything else that we're going to talk about today will be a statewide focus. This is the one exception. I wanted to show that the losses and gains have varied throughout the state. You can see, and this data is by place of work. So when you see that 4,200 jobs have been lost in the North Slope, keep in mind that a lot of those people, most of those people don't live on the North Slope. They live throughout the state, and about a third of them live outside of Alaska. You can see Anchorage has lost the biggest number of jobs, 6,084. On a percentage basis, North Slope losses would be by far the biggest. Mat-Su stands out possibly, one, because it's in the middle of the state, but more so because it didn't lose jobs over this period. It briefly fell below year-ago levels, very briefly. But over this three-year period, Mat-Su added about 770 jobs. The source of those jobs, 450 of them were healthcare, and another 150 of them were local government. And that's useful to mention partly because Mat-Su is the exception in the state and the outlier in terms of strong population growth for years now. It's a little bit like healthcare geographically. It just keeps growing. Mat-Su does, and it sticks out on all of the data for quite a while now. But what growth brings every time is healthcare growth and local government growth. People require healthcare. People require local government services. So that's a little microcosm that I wanted to mention. Another thing I wanted to point out is that for the first time in Alaska's history, we've had net migration losses for six consecutive years. The losses in themselves aren't particularly large. We lost much more numerically and especially as a percentage basis in the 1980s. But the longest period before this time that we've lost jobs in consecutive years is four. Four have been the most consecutive years. Another point to make here is that you can see how large Alaska's migration flows are. We have for many, many years have had the largest migration flows among states. Second biggest has been Nevada. So we have this strong pull to Alaska, and then we have this push away from Alaska. Hawaii is interesting to compare the data to because they're a little bit similar to us. It's a big move to Alaska. It's not necessarily a big move from New York to New Jersey. But this defines kind of the amount that we've grown for sure, just mathematically. But you also learn some things about the decisions people are making about their desire to live in a place. You learn even more so, I think, how important jobs are to driving those numbers. You see that we haven't had a big increase in people leaving. We have a big decrease in people coming over this period. And when I say big, as you can see, these numbers don't vary enormously. But that's more what's driving the change and the numbers getting bigger in net migration.
Mr. Chairman, if I may, real quick.
Representative LeBon.
Do these numbers include military in and out?
Through the chair, Representative LeBon, they do. If the military, if the service members and their families define Alaska as their primary residence. So there's some squishiness in there, right? Some of them may say, my real home is Alabama. I'm just stationed here. Some of them might say Alaska is now my primary place of residence.
If I may, do you have a feel for how typical it is for a new military member or family to declare Alaska as their primary home?
Representative LeBon, and I might even, through the chair, back up a little bit, because the way we handle the military is we add them in, them and their dependents. So I'm gonna make a mental note to follow up with you more specifically, because as my first slide showed, the population of Alaska is very impacted by active duty military. So that alone suggests most of them are in, whether that's a behind the scenes statistical issue we wrestle with or not. The way we track and identify residency in other contexts is asking people whether this is their primary residence. Military, there's probably some nuance. I'll get back with you on that and the committee. Uh, Another point is that Alaska's economy has underperformed the country and every other state over this 3-year period of our job loss. The states that are down there that haven't performed particularly well over this period, the other states tell us something. North Dakota and Wyoming, they both small populations. Wyoming is the smallest state in the country. North Dakota used to be smaller than Alaska. It has about 20,000 more people than Alaska. The other state that's smaller than Alaska is Vermont. But North Dakota and Wyoming both they depend heavily on natural resources to drive their economy. Oil, in Wyoming's case, coal. I don't know how much coal there is in North Dakota, but both of them, the main thing they share with us, well, in Alaska, of course, has some coal employment too. But for us, the oil is far larger. And Wyoming, I'm not sure the balance, but either way, they depend on oil and also coal.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Josephson.
Thank you, through the chair. Mr. Robinson, the slide is noteworthy because, as you said, our the other producing states have suffered as Alaska has. And I'm wondering, there's two approaches to our recession. One is to not just watch it and be laissez-faire about it, but to intervene in some way to incentivize growth. But am I right that Alaska has frequently been off cycle? And I'm thinking of the Great Recession, which was so devastating, among the most devastating of the 20th century, and Alaska virtually didn't suffer anything. What can we take from the fact that we're just off cycle a lot?
Representative Joseph, through the chair, it's I think the most condensed version of a response would be that we have independent drivers from the U.S. So think of large scale manufacturing in the U.S. for example, when the U.S. was losing. I was going to say tens of thousands, I could probably say millions of manufacturing jobs. That had no impact on Alaska. We never had that kind of employment. Oil prices are probably the most consistent example of something that is good for Alaska. High oil prices, good for Alaska, bad for the U.S. And really, sometimes, often, bad for individual Alaskans. High oil prices mean high diesel fuel costs. It means extra costs. It means extra transportation costs. But for the state as a whole, without much doubt, high oil prices bring a lot of revenue into the state. It's a positive. High oil prices are negative for the U.S. Sometimes people ask whether we're counter-cyclical or whether we lag. Not consistently enough to expect it to be continued. I think a better way of thinking about it is that we have different drivers.
Thank you.
Why haven't we been growing? Well, we hinted at that when we called out Wyoming and North Dakota, and let's look a little bit more at those two states in particular. Not because we're identical to Wyoming and North Dakota, we're not. We're very different, but we have strong similarities. So any state comparison needs to acknowledge that there are differences. But to not do it would be to miss out on an opportunity to get some context and to learn something, to diagnose what's going well or what's not going well. So what the main analytical point I wanted to make here is that they had similar downturns, similar in terms of timing. The depth of their losses was substantially more than ours. But Wyoming resumed growing in mid-2017. North Dakota resumed growing in early 2018. As I mentioned, we're now 39 months in, and if we've resumed growing, it's just barely, and the revised data will kind of help us determine that. Another way to look at that is our 1980s recession. So here we have, again, a deeper, shorter recession. Another thing I'll mention here, notice to the left of the graph how strong we were growing, and if I went back a couple more years, that growth would be even stronger. In the early 80s, we were really growing fast, and that's part of what was responsible for the depth of the recession. Oil prices played the biggest role then as well as now. But when we were out kind of strongly. You see the almost mirror image of the degree that we went in, the degree we come out. And a little bit that's true of the current period as well. We were growing only very modestly going into the recession. And then when we come out, or the trajectory now suggests when we come out, it won't be with a roar. It'll be more with a whimper.
Got a question, Representative Johnston?
Thank you. It's kind of interesting when you look at these comparisons and you look at particularly North Dakota, which has been a relatively new oil play, how similar the graphs are. And the maturities, the fee, I'd never seen this before. It'd be interesting just to overlay that too.
Representative Johnston, through the chair, I had the same reaction. And North Dakota's oil industry is very young, like ours was in the 80s. I was looking at some data. It's hard to isolate oil in different states' data, but they went from about 7,000 jobs in the category that includes oil and gas to 30,000 very fast. And then they lost about half of them very fast, and now they're back to a very high. But yeah, young, volatile, quick to come, quick to go away. Our oil jobs didn't go away quickly, but I had the same reaction. This is a younger oil industry.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So using Wyoming and North Dakota as who we're comparing to, the size of government or amount of employees that we have in the government sector, whether you're talking state, you know, or federal, how does that compare to these other states and how many government workers that they have per population?
Representative Wilson, through the chair, we wrote about that a couple of years ago and found when we pulled hospitals out that we ranked third at the time. Well, let me back up. In response to a similar request, we updated that data to as current as we could get it. And when we did that work, we rank third now. State and local government jobs per capita. Wyoming was number one. I'm pretty sure North Dakota was number two. And it's important, I mentioned state and local government jobs combined, because as you know, our state government does a lot here that local governments, in particular county governments, do in other states. So on and we did look at state governments specifically, jobs per capita and local government jobs per capita, and then joined them together and ranked them. And I'd be glad to share that information.
Follow up?
Well, I guess it's back to North Dakota being new into the oil fields. It'll be interesting to see if they grow government the same way we did when we were kind of booming, you know, as far as oil goes. Have they had, as far as their government resources, have they seen the same type of budget issues in the last 5 years that we're currently seeing?
Representative Wilson, through the chair, I hesitate to talk too much about that because I'm not a budget expert. I had many of those same questions. One of the things I noticed is that going into the recession, they collected about $2 billion from a combination of state income tax and state sales tax. They have both. Wyoming only has a sales tax. Their spending data was harder to understand. And that's a possibility that I'm misreading. I don't think so. Their broad-based sales tax was I think the smaller of the two, but combined before things went south, it was about $2 billion. It went clear down to $1.1 billion or something, and is now starting to rebound.
And one more question.
Over.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So and when we're talking about job loss, do you have a comparison between government job losses within these states versus the private sector for each one of the states, just to kind of get a better understanding? Because I know down in the lower 48, there used to be a lot of incentives to move businesses across state lines because there'd be better incentives to, for instance, possibly going from North Dakota to South Dakota, so a business, you know, possibly would move that. But you don't have that same thing happening in the government world.
Representative Wilson, through the chair, that's easy to get. So that is unlike oil, which is a little bit harder to isolate in the state data. Public sector, private sector is very easy to get. So I'd be glad to follow up with the committee with that data.
Appreciate that. Thank you.
Early on, when we started to look, when oil prices fell and it looked like we were going to head into a recession, which I'll just loosely define as a broad-based economic downturn. We took a look at the extended period of time where states had suffered some kind of a extended period of downturn, and this pie chart is one of the results. So 259 times states lost jobs for at least 9 months compared to year-ago levels. And of those 259 times, 17% of the time they were growing again in less than a year, 58% of the time within 2 years, et cetera. So 75% of the time, state downturns, state recessions last 2 years or less. If you bring in the 2 to 3 years slice of the pie, that takes you clear up to 93% of the time when states lose jobs, they're growing again within 3 years. And then Alaska is currently in this red slice where we've lost jobs now for 3+ years. And the one time that a state lost jobs for even longer than that was Michigan in the 2000s, when they were really losing for good most of the employment related to their auto industry. The auto industry isn't gone, but employment, the old way of making cars, is pretty much gone. As part of that same study, we looked at the percentage of times that states were adding jobs, and you can see that Alaska, this was up to 2016, but Alaska was growing in 89% of the months over that 55-year period. The United States, 82%. At the very far left, Michigan was the smallest percentage at about 67%. But the point here that I wanted to make was that the default status of an economy is job growth. We don't grow half the time and not grow half the time. The history of certainly the country and Alaska even more so is growth is what's normal. If we recalculated these percentages to show the last 4 years, because it's such a long period of time, it doesn't change a lot. We're still at 84%, I think. You add 40 months to this 55-year period. So the reason we asked why recessions sometimes lasted longer, why we dug into that, was not for historian-type purposes. We wanted to see if we could learn anything about Alaska's economy. One of the things we learned is that when recessions do extend beyond 3 years, you could point to almost all the time, a fairly specific reason. So Oregon, in the early 1980s, for example, they were losing their timber industry for good. It wasn't going away. It wasn't a typical recession where something overheats and then you get a market correction and then normalcy resumes. It was the permanent loss of a piece of their economy. Michigan was similar. Connecticut was interesting. There was a period when they were losing manufacturing, defense spending, and the financial sector all at the same time. So that's another way things can happen. If segments of your economy independently, if several of them get hit at the same time, it would be, for Alaska, if gold and zinc and salmon prices all fell at the same time. Those are two things that are unrelated, but they might be enough to push our numbers negative. So then the other, just the first bullet, uncertainty. One of our conclusions in that article we did was that when oil prices fell and we started to lose jobs, it looked like, with a fair amount of certainty, that would precipitate the need for this structural change in how Alaska does state government. For years, oil paid our bills. Whether that was ever going to be sustainable, we saw that oil production was doing what it was doing, the revenue we were getting was doing what it was doing, population was growing, and it looked like at some point we would have to do what we're wrestling with now, which is shrink state government, do something about the dividend, create taxes. Savings gave us some time, but as we're navigating those hard, really more hard politically than hard economically questions, that has created uncertainty, and that's a drag on our economy. And then that's a little bit of a fuzzy concept, but it's an important one, and there are real costs. The second bullet is more concrete, which is we've made some subtractions from our economy, and anytime you take money out of an economy, all other things being equal, you're less likely to grow. So third question I hope you're as curious about as I am is are we coming out now? What do the data show? I come from the Department of Labor, and that's one of the reasons jobs are paramount in my mind. But really, jobs are the main measure over time of economic health, not because they're perfect, but because they represent lots of things, and they go with a lot of these other economic metrics that also, in and of themselves, tell us something about economic health. So what I've chosen here are, not what I've chosen, these are kind of obvious choices, gross domestic product. So that's the value, the market value of all the goods and services produced in Alaska. That means the value of our oil. A really important point is that doesn't mean that value stays here. That's the value that started here, that came from here. Some of that value goes to shareholders of oil companies. Some of that value goes to lots of leakage is one of the ways we describe it. And you can see that's a pretty volatile number. So all of these metrics are shown on this graph as percent change, and then the black line is 2%, which represents average inflation over that 2006 to 2018 period. But you can see gross domestic product has been up now for several quarters, and this data only goes through third quarter of 2018. That's as recent as we have available. So another quarter will be available soon, or has transpired. But I don't have much doubt at all that trajectory will go. Continue to go up. We know it might flatten out a little bit because of oil prices. Production's flat, and oil really does push those numbers around more than anything else. Moving to wages, you can see that wages have now also been up above inflation for a couple of quarters. And personal income, that's wages plus income from investments. It's sometimes dividends, interest, and rent. So if you're a landlord, if you your investment earnings, those kinds of things. And then the other category is something called transfer payments. So that's Social Security, that's unemployment insurance. In Alaska, that's the permanent fund dividend. That's where it shows up in this transfer payment category. But all three of those metrics give strong signs of us coming out of the recession.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So on a slide, and you're kind of going into this. So what has a bigger impact on the recession, cutting government services or taking more out of the PFD and money going into our communities?
Senator Wilson, through the chair, I'll give you an answer that you'll hear enough to make you pull your hair out from economists. It depends. Right? It depends on, and the dividend is very specific. It's concrete. Whether we know what we're going to talk about that more like we talked about, but the it depends that really matters is what, how we cut government spending. An example that I used that I stumbled on that I kind of liked was, think of what happens to K-12 if K-12 has a $100 million budget cut by taking all of that money out of teacher salaries. So you've got X number of jobs suddenly gone. That's one end of the spectrum. Another end of the spectrum is if they said, we will not do any activity-related travel, we will not buy any art supplies, we will, all of those things, the net impact of that on jobs, very, very different. So.
Follow up, Mr. Chairman?
Follow up.
First of all, it's Representative Wilson.
I'm sorry, what did I say?
Senator. We look alike.
Okay.
So, and one reason I asked the question is because the first year that the permanent fund dividend was reduced and reduced abruptly, you didn't see the same spending as you saw where, back to the predictability, where everyone knew that they may not have known the exact amount that it was going to be, but that they knew there was going to be an amount going and they had no problem spending it because next year, kind of like your tax return, you're going to get it again. But I heard from a lot of retailers that the first year that it was done, that kind of that mentality wasn't there because no longer did the public feel like it was going to be an automatic. They may get some, they may not, they didn't do that. So for that year, I could really see the difference in what happened to the economy. But I'm just trying to, you know, I know it depends on it, but if I kind of look at the years that we've done it, it kind of makes me wonder, though, whether or not the dividend actually had more impact on the recession because people didn't know about that. But I guess what you're saying, too, if you don't know whether you're going to have a job tomorrow either, you're not going to spend money in the same fashion, and both take out of, you know, take it out of our local, you know, our local retailers.
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, yes, shifting focus specifically to the dividend, we've looked hard for employment impact, mostly because, again, Department of Labor, that's what we, you know, employment and jobs, and it's hard to find one, and we'll talk about that a little bit in a minute with some other slides. It's hard to see positive or negative an employment impact of the dividend. That does not mean that when it gets bigger or smaller, Alaskans don't get richer or poorer. The question really, in terms of impact on the economy, is how Alaskans spend that money, whether they spend that money, whether they spend that money in Alaska. So those are all interesting questions, and it probably changes over time. You mentioned uncertainty. If you think that you might be losing your job, you're much more likely to spend your dividend maybe paying off credit card bills than taking a trip to fill in the blank. Yeah.
Thank you. Representative Johnston, and then Knopp.
A follow-up to that, it's always interesting to look at historical data. And 2008, I think it was, we had a dividend plus an additional dividend to reflect the high cost of heat, and I think it was about $3,300. It'd be interesting to compare that data with current dividends. I mean, just look at that historically. There's a chance to go back as far as how it affects the labor, because that was a time when we were not in a recession. We were very rich with jobs. The market was taking a tumble, but Alaska wasn't. So anyways, I'd like to see a historical.
Representative Johnston, through the chair, you're going to in about 15 seconds, because we had the same question and the same thought, and I've got a slide showing exactly that time period. Yeah.
Got Representative Knopp.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So in the 2009 time frame on your chart there, you see where GDP and wages and personal income kind of track each other. But in the 15-16 time frame, they kind of go the other way. GDP drops and wages and personal income actually rise a little bit. What's the relationship there? What changed?
Representative Knopp, through the chair, in the period you highlight, oil prices fell, and that had an outsized impact on GDP. I'm trying to think of the years, 2011 maybe, out of our total GDP, $20 billion, out of about $60 billion was tied to oil. A few years later, that $20 billion had become $6 billion, $5.6 billion, somewhere in there. So we go from oil making up a third of our total value of our goods and services to about a tenth over a very brief period. That kind of a plunge in gross domestic product is nowhere near matched by declines in wages or personal income, which does measure what stays in Alaska. So the short answer is oil. And if I could add another point along those same lines, if you look back at 2008, talking about that large dividend, that especially large with the resource rebate, you see personal income pop up and wages not pop up. That is the especially large dividend. That's an extra $1.1 billion in personal income going into our economy. And the total amount was actually $2.2 billion, but $1.1 billion more than the previous year. Kind of a nice example of what a supersized dividend might do to an economy. All time periods are different, so with that caveat.
Please continue.
So I was thinking it was the very next slide. I was hoping it was the very next slide, because that would have been especially fun. But we, with a few kind of formal exceptions, we mostly, like I mentioned, produce current data to tell you what's happening now and examine trends and try to be relevant to the questions that you and others are making about how our economy works. And if you do this here, what happens over there? This is our 2019 employment forecast. We did the work towards the end of the year We publish this every year in January, and we were forecasting that we would grow in 2019. But you can see my big but there. When we did this work, 100% of this work, there was no talk yet of a $1.6 billion budget cut. Our assumption would have been, and you can see that we forecasted a decline of 200 state government jobs, so our assumption was that the same downward pressure that there had been on state government would stay in place. We hadn't yet, we'd taken this big first step of solving our budget issue with the percent of market value, this new revenue stream, but there's work to do, as you all know, so there was no reason to expect that suddenly state government job numbers would roar back. But we also weren't wrestling at all with the notion of a budget cut of this size that we're talking about now. So that's important for chronology. I wouldn't want somebody to say the Department of Labor has said that a $1.6 billion job cut won't stop us from growing in 2019. The sequence of those things is important. And how are we at forecasting? How good are we? Good's the wrong word. How accurate are we? How close and even accurate? Generally, we have a pretty good sense of where our economy's headed. In 2009, you can see we identified that we were going to stop growing. In 2016, same thing. We're not spot on. There are enough things happening that we don't always get it to the tenth of a percentage point, but fairly close. The trends, economies and especially jobs, and this is jobs, don't move the way oil prices do. They move fairly slowly and within a fairly narrow band. And to reinforce what we talked about earlier, this recession has been shallow. The changes have been slow moving. And just this there are two points to this slide that if we had in our minds, if we knew that there was a possibility we might have budget cuts of this magnitude, these are the ones that for sure would change. I can't say how much because we don't know the details yet, and we don't know the likelihood that these changes will come into effect and that we'll be dealing with a new reality starting July 1st. But without any question, local government would be a new number. State government would be a new number. Leisure and hospitality, that would be a new number because to the extent locals are driving that and locals would spend less, that number is going to change. Healthcare, of course, would change. Retail trade is another one where it says something about confidence and how much disruption there is in the economy. So that number would change. And then those numbers roll up to total private sector and total non-farm employment. So to Representative Johnson's point, in 2007, we had a permanent fund dividend of about $1,600. In 2008, the statutory formula produced a number of 2069. Oil prices were very high. Oil revenue was very high. Oil prices were very high, heating oil. Alaskans were suffering from high oil prices. And the decision was made by the administration, the legislature, to return $1,200 of that back to Alaskans in the form of a resource rebate. So we go from a $1,600 PFD to a $3,200 PFD. What the chart here shows is the blue line 2007 employment, 2008 employment by month. And sometime in August, there was announcement, there was legislation passed, in fact, that this resource rebate was going to be added to the statutory formula. The specific amounts were announced in September, and then the dividend was distributed, as it always is, in October. And what you see here is it's hard to see anything, right? You don't see much of a jump. That doesn't mean, again, that Alaskans weren't overnight $1.1 billion richer as a whole. But how did they spend that money? Did it make more money for sales of stores? Almost certainly. Did it make Alaskans college savings programs for their kids higher? Almost certainly. Did it reduce their credit? Almost certainly. All those things. But short term, no discernible employment impact. And I think we see that even, so we keep looking, right? This is a nice case study. We did a little bit at the time, and we've looked at this off and on over the years because it's an important Alaska issue. Here you can see, we believe, a small temporary short-term, small temporary employment boost from the higher dividend. So again, 2007 is the blue line. 2008, we start the year above year-ago levels, so we're still growing. Remember, we're just about to head into this short recession that was a very big, deep recession for the United States. But so in about the summer of 2008, we dropped below year-ago levels, so we're starting to lose jobs. And then October comes around, and we pop back up a little bit. So we go from being a little bit below year-ago levels for retail government jobs. We're back up. A few months later, we're back below year-ago levels. Be careful not to put too much weight on this kind of analysis because, again, lots of things are always happening in an economy. But if you're looking for the dividend making very large changes to an economy, even when you see the kind of $1,600 to $3,200 jump that we saw then, you just don't see them in our data. And I believe that's my last slide. I'd be glad to answer any questions you have.
Representative Wilson and then Josephson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So could we get on slide 18, can we get an update of this slide, what it would look like with the proposed reductions of the current budget? Because if I understood you correctly, you said that the chart was made based on kind of what we were doing in the past, but not to the budget that we currently have in front of us.
Representative Wilson, through the chair, so you're asking if you could get what these numbers would have been if the budget as written is passed?
Yes.
That would, the short answer is that would probably require us to be all hands on deck for months, and you'd stop getting the current data. We've never done something like that. We're a little bit like, and this is a little bit of self-grandiosity, but we're a little bit like the revenue sources book. There's a schedule, there's a process, it's long, I don't want to say it's hard because, but it's art and science. And again, I think we don't yet, so if you said, here's $300,000, stop everything you're doing, go do that right now, we don't yet have nearly enough of an understanding of what the budget would do and where to know how these things would move. It's new territory. I mean, the ferry is new territory. The level of cuts to the university, for example, is a new territory. So, respectfully, no, that's not easy for us to do.
Follow up, Mr. Chairman.
Follow up.
Well, we had $300,000. I'd be more than happy to give it to you, but obviously, we don't have $300,000.
Thank you.
But actually, feel our pain. I mean, I really do respect the answer you just gave because, in a nutshell, that's what we're absolutely battling with in a short time. We don't have all the expertise that, I mean, just so you know, I read your book religiously.
Thank
you. So, you know, it doesn't just go in my pile on that. But I guess my point is I don't know how we make some of the decisions that have been put before us without having that data. And I also understand that it would probably take a lot to be able to do that. If you could just go back and just see if there's even a proposed, you know, just, you know, maybe based on it, if there's even a shot you can give without the $300,000, I would really appreciate it. But I have one other question too. As we're talking especially about jobs more than necessarily just influx of more cash into the private sector, the tax structure that we have continued, and I know we're not supposed to talk about oil taxes, but since, you know, that's where we've seen a lot of the jobs lost, and now we're looking at possibly taxes for the fishing industry or whether it's oil, you know, how much impact as we're just a discussion point, not necessarily what we pass, does that affect possibly the private business world and jobs just based on what we might do here?
Representative Wilson, through the chair, one conceptual way to think about it that might be helpful is to think about those things as either additions or subtractions from our economy. So If, for example, we reduce the dividend by $1 billion, that's a extraction from our economy. Although even then you have to say, where's the money coming from? What are we doing with it next? So you've got these offsetting, potentially partially offsetting economic forces. Taxes is another example. If we suddenly had a tax that generated $1 billion of revenue, we know where that comes from, whoever we tax. If it's a sales tax, it comes from Alaska and non-Alaska consumers. If it's an income tax, it comes from Alaska resident and non-resident income earners. So that's an extraction, that's a subtraction from our economy. What we do with it will, of course, affect how much that offsets the money we've taken out of Alaskans' pockets. So conceptually, I hope that's a little bit helpful.
Just a clarification. So if we're looking at companies putting in hundreds of millions of dollars into projects, and they have a spreadsheet that says, if I do this, this is what I'm going to get, and to know that, you know, every year, or possibly maybe they're blessed every 2 years, you know, those numbers now, as I'm getting ready to go out and do it, have now changed, or I've already invested, and it's changing. As you've seen, how many times we've changed, especially our oil tax structure, it doesn't matter whether you agree or disagree with what we've done as far as the bottom line, but how, you know, does this refer to the jobs, especially in the oil fields, of where we used to have more structure? It seemed like we had a bigger boom, and now, luckily, we're not completely flat, but it just seems like everybody's on hold. How do we possibly create that incentive again to go after those jobs that we know that, you know, the high-paying ones, and make it so that people can actually live here?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, that's probably the key anchor that we're dragging, is uncertainty. Businesses, individual consumers don't like uncertainty. And when I say they don't like uncertainty, what it does, it makes them conservative in their spending, and it makes them less likely to invest. Musin Gutabi, we cited him in a recent article, and he wrestled with trying to quantify that and came up with about between $200 and $600 million a year in personal private capital investment that doesn't happen because of the very things you're describing, uncertainty. It's hard to 5-year plan. It's hard to 10-year plan because you don't know for sure what Alaska's tax structure. The dividend, I don't think that is a big impact on companies' willingness to invest in Alaska, but it's possible. The type of a state we will have, right? We're answering some foundational questions about the type of state we'll have, how much we're going to spend on K-12, how much we're going to spend on university, how much we're going to spend on public safety, and all the health care, all those things.
Thank you. And just a question to you, Mr. Chairman. The point of not being able to get possible data that we would need, and I find it fascinating that he got to 300,000 really fast, so I'm kind of curious how that amount specifically came out. But I think the point being that these are major decisions, and it's not going to just be about the services we have, but the employment portions of that, and I don't know whether we could find another access to be able to do that, to be able to get those kind of points in a quick term, but I think that's information we need as we're making decisions on, you know, what to possibly put back in the budget, what things that we really can do if we don't know all the consequences to what we may do on our economy. Thank you.
Good point. Thank you. We have in the queue Representative Josephson, Johnston, and LeBon. Representative Josephson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Through the chair, your page 20 of your PowerPoint, Mr. Robinson, shows the time in response, just coincidentally to Representative Johnson's question. When the dividend was doubled, it seemed to, at least in retail trade, it seemed to show a discernible improvement for a couple months. And I'm trying to gauge the value of that thing, which coincidentally was sort of on the, as we were moving into the holidays at that period, to what ICER reports, which is that there's a loss of about 1,600 jobs per $100 million. Which would suggest 16,000 jobs statewide, and possible out-migration from that. And I, obviously, the dividend is 700,000 people spending that money, as opposed to 16,000 folks earning a living that pays a mortgage and all of the associated things in their lives. Can you help me make sense out of those two things?
Representative Josephson, through the chair. A part of the answer is the timing. So anytime money comes into an economy, you're going to create economic growth over some time horizon. So the fact that we don't see a blip in our data that's discernible doesn't mean there isn't an employment impact, especially longer term. So I'm glad you asked that question, because I don't want anybody to misinterpret what I'm saying is it has no effect on employment, just it doesn't have a discernible impact over this short-term period. Another point along those lines is that, well, I might have just lost my frame of thought.
I was talking about the loss of employment vis-a-vis the dividend not being doubled. And how to sort of wrestle with those two things.
Gotcha. Right. So the timing, and then understand too that anything that's modeled is built on historical relationships. So for example, historically, when X amount of increased wages go into an economy, because there's a certain relationship, there's an assumption that X amount of employment goes up. The dividend's special that way, And ICER does really great work, that work done by Musin Gutabi, Gunnar Knapp, and Matt Berman. They know Alaska's economy about as well as anyone. So they'll answer for the specifics of kind of their modeling and really what they learn and the adjustments they've made from these times in our history where we've seen similar movements. But I do think the best answer to avoid people thinking we've got contradictory conclusions is this time horizon and the possibility that because these numbers are so big and kind of specific that you would expect to see a blip. And I know what I was thinking about before. So a couple of examples where we do see discernible employment impact. So the 64 earthquake, very obvious. Exxon Valdez oil spill, we can see that in our numbers. This most recent earthquake, not so much. We think we see a little bit of a construction spike. Medicaid expansion, we can see when that goes in. We can see an employment increase from that. But those are all the stimulus was one we looked at a little bit. I can't remember what we saw. But there it's a short list of things that are big enough to have a discernible, that's an important word, employment impact.
Thank you.
Hey, Representative Johnston.
Hi, thank you. I've seen you give various presentations, and I think it's always worthy, especially since it's somewhat of a science and it requires modeling, just to have you maybe share with us your background.
Thank you for asking, Representative Johnson. I'm trying to think. I don't like talking about my background a ton, but I have an economics degree. I have a law degree. I've spent time working for economic consultants doing kind of energy-related work for the Department of Energy in a D.C. area consulting firm. I worked for a few years at McDowell Group here in Juneau, but I'm a recovering attorney. I haven't practiced law since 2001. So really since 2001, I've been doing this kind of work, except for a couple of years at McDowell, all at the Department of Labor.
Thank you.
Representative LeBon and then Carpenter.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a comment followed by a quick question. My comment is, in my previous life as a banker, I used your monthly studies to help calculate the bank's allowance for loan and loss, a quarterly calculation that the FDIC appreciated the analysis, and I was just using your information, so thank you.
Thank you.
The question is, I'm often asked why not a state income tax to tax those out-of-state workers that fly over our head and land up on the North Slope, and that's a way to pull in some new revenue. Do you have an opinion about how much of new revenue that might be?
Representative LeBon, through the chair, certainly not an opinion on the wisdom. That's a policy choice, obviously, but that's not what you asked. How much it would generate would depend on the tax rate. And then I'll just use this opportunity to mention some data that we produce every year. The number and the percentage with a lot of detail of non-resident workers. So about 20% of all workers in Alaska are non-residents. in the oil industry, it was as high as 37% a few years ago. It dropped to about 34% in 2017, the most recent data we have available. But we also know the wages that go to residents and non-residents. And I'd be glad to follow up with the committee with that report.
Quick follow-up. The percentage of employment that comes from out of state, that's about, did you say 18% or 20%?
Representative LeBond, through the chair, it's a little bit different than employment. It's workers. So what we do is we tally all of the people who worked in the state over the calendar year, and of that group, 80% of them are residents, and it's roughly 80, and 20% are non-resident. By the PFD definition of residency, which is rigorous, you have to be here, you're familiar, the whole full calendar year, all those things.
So. Okay, thank you.
Representative Carpenter, and then Kanaan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Robinson, for coming in today. As you were responding to Representative Wilson's question, it was something that was spurring my thoughts there. I have similar thinking, and I was wondering if kind of in a rhetorical question, that whether we should pass a budget and then update our forecast to see what it's going to do. And that would probably be getting the cart before the horse in which should come first. So I can think of no more helpful tool for the legislators to use than using science and data to help us understand what a transformational budget is going to look like after we figure out whatever it is, the agreements that we could reach, and what that budget is that gets passed was made based on data and some sort of modeling to help us understand what it is we're trying to do. The governor's asked us to pass a budget that changes the size and scope of our state government, and we all know that appears that it is putting a burden onto the local governments to pick up some of the burden that the state used to pay for. And I think what's going around in our minds, in the public's mind, is this even doable? And I can think of no other person, a group, that would be in a position to be able to help us influence that decision and understand what it is that we're about to do. So I don't particularly like the answer that says we can't do it. I think there's nothing more important right now than for us to understand the data and a best guess based on science going forward.
Representative Carpenter, through the chair, I share your frustration when I think about the sequence that, well, isn't that nice? We know what's going to happen, or what is happening now that we've pulled the trigger on some of these decisions. But really, we are not the experts on economic modeling of scenarios. That's not what we do hardly ever. So I could say and we will wrestle with that in 2020 when we're looking ahead. But that's a separate type of work. The economists at ICER do that kind of work very specifically. If this, then what? Using sophisticated economic models that are constantly under construction. That's not what we do. We do, it's more meat and potatoes stuff. We tell you how many jobs there are. As I've said here today, trying to understand what's moving them, that's a task you can't ever complete with 100% satisfaction. It's part science, but it's very much part art. I remember hearing at the beginning of this recession from longtime people familiar with Alaska's economy that we might lose 100,000 jobs in this recession. And I, in the audience, I rolled my eyes a little bit. I thought those are people who don't understand kind of Alaska's history, or they've forgotten temporarily, because that's out of the range of possibilities. And I told myself also, well, that's possible. Lots of things are possible. But the extent to which we can know the response of the economy to the change, to the decisions you're going to have to make, is very limited. It's conceptual. It's broad-based. So we can't tell you, nobody can tell you with a lot of precision, if you cut this department's budget by this amount, that will have this kind of an impact.
Representative Knopp.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. thanks, Dan, for the good information. Appreciate it. So you talked about employment numbers. So I kind of got two questions here, maybe two-part question. So you talked about 80-20, 80% being resident, 20% being non-resident. But have you ever gauged that percentage in seasonal employment? You know, because we reference income tax and we talk about the high wage earners. But in reality, if you combine it between the hospitality, the fishing industry, and others who participate seasonally. So I guess I'm kind of curious, number one, that's the first question. Seasonal employment rates, does it shift significant, 80-20, 60-40, where does that go? And then this will be an opinion piece. Do you think if we had a state income tax and so I always have concerns about today when you try to hire people, they simply aren't there. And so if you had a tax like that, would it be detrimental? Would it be significant to our workforce, especially the seasonal ones? Would they come? Would they not come? Because, as you know, the hospitality, Alaska Railroad, others utilize a lot of that. And so sometimes when we talk about revenue, I have my concerns broadened to, are we impacting our labor force so much that we're hurting ourselves? So just your thoughts on that.
Representative Knopp, through the chair, to your first question. Oh, I had it solidly. Oh, right. Seasonality of non-resident workers. We have employment and wage data in particular by quarter, and this report that I mentioned, we do show the worker counts by quarter. And what we see is that the non-resident workers do tend to be less likely to work all four quarters of the year. So non-residents are more likely to work at one or two or three quarters. Resident workers are more likely to show up working all four quarters, which is what you'd expect probably, especially when you think of things like construction, seafood processing, those kinds of things. So there's something fairly close to what you're talking about in this report that I'll submit to the committee. The second question, many of the decisions you face in terms of solving this kind of structural issue we're talking about, they're pure policy, not pure policy choices, because all of them have different economic impacts. Anytime you tax, you create less of an incentive to do the thing you're taxing. Taxes are how people pay for state government, federal, state, and local. So those will have different impacts in different areas. But I do sometimes wonder if we think this option or that option is more powerful in an economy than it really is. And I would conceptually, if I'm thinking about this, I would think about how much, again, as I said to Representative Wilson, how much of an extraction is this from an economy? Who is it coming from? What are they doing with that money? If you tax a high earner versus a low earner, the low earner's income is more likely to be spent. A high earner's income is more likely to be saved and not circulating. So lots of important questions, most of them not economic, but policy preference.
Actually, Representative Josephson?
Yeah, just real quickly, if I could, through the chair, Mr. Robinson, the passage of Senate Bill 26 by itself introduced a new source of income into the economy that was, quote, unnatural, at least it was anomalous and had never happened before. In that respect, we did ourselves some good, did we not?
Representative Josephson, through the chair, absolutely. That's and did ourselves some good in several ways. One, bringing some, and there's an exchange, as you know, between short-term and long-term. But we brought some money that was on the sidelines into our economy to the tune of $2.5-3 billion a year. So that's important. Something else it did is it diversified our revenue flow. So instead of being really tied into oil, we now have this investment. It's tied to national and international markets and the permanent fund investment officers and all of that, and their ability to generate money based on how the world is doing. So that's two. And then the third one is that it gets us a long way towards solving this structural problem of state government. Not all the way, but a big step.
Thank you.
Representative Sullivan Leonard.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a quick question, if I could, Mr. Robinson. On page 5, where you show the total job loss or gain across Alaska since 2015, for the North Slope, do you have an ability to break down where the workers live? Because we know on the North Slope, it's not all North Slope residents there. Do you have an ability to break that down?
Thank you. Through the chair, Representative Sullivan Leonard, we do. With a fair amount of precision, and it's in this report that I mentioned, and I wish I was a little sharper and I would give you some numbers. I'm not going to. As I mentioned, about a third of them don't live in Alaska. Very few of them live in Southeast Alaska. A lot of them live in Fairbanks. A lot of them live in Anchorage. A lot of them live in Mat-Su. A lot of them live in the Kenai Peninsula Borough. And there's some logic to that, too, because those areas, they're oil and gas fields suppliers. They're people with connections. Proximity, obviously, you can get to the slope from Fairbanks and Anchorage easier than you can from Bethel or Nome or those other parts of the state.
Thank you, Mr. Robinson. If I could get that breakdown, I would like to see that.
Absolutely.
You know, as much as the numbers in Mat-Su look really great, we know a large number of our population did work up on the North Slope. And so as many of those slope workers came home, some of the jobs then that they looked for in my district were all retail. And so certainly not the livable wage jobs that they certainly had. And I just wanted to look at the numbers for that. Okay, thank you.
Representative Merrick.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Through the chair, the one-third of slope workers, are they taking jobs from Alaskans, or do we not have the workforce to support that industry?
Representative Merrick, through the chair, such a rich question. Part of the answer is the reason we collect and disseminate this data is so that we can, they're high wage jobs, as you all know. So if we can get an Alaskan in there, that benefits the state. So we can, tailor and think about the training that's done, the university curriculum, all those things to maximize the number of Alaskans in those jobs. What Alaskans sometimes don't wrestle with hard enough, I don't think, is the freedom that a 2-week on, 2-week off schedule gives to a worker to live anywhere. So some of those workers are former Alaskans who decide that it's cheaper to live in Spokane or Houston or whatever else. So sometimes we sometimes act as if there's a taking that happens when a non-resident shows up working on the slope, and kind of, but what we see most often is when the number of resident workers goes up, the number of non-resident workers also goes up. So historically, 16 out of the last 20 years, they moved together. Most recently, both went down. So among other things, that strongly suggests it's not there are 10,000 jobs, are they going to Alaskans or not Alaskans? There's an oil and gas industry that's trying to do what they do, which is make money and, you know, pump oil, all those things, and they'll hire who they can hire who's qualified to do the work.
Any further questions? Seeing no further questions, thank you very much, Mr. Robinson, for coming. And we will move on to our next and final presentation. That is the economic impact analysis for the governor's proposed fiscal plan by Mr. King. And I also see in the audience we have OMB Director Donna Ardwin, as well as Department of Revenue's Commissioner Designee Bruce Tangeman. Mr. King, if you could please come to the table and put yourself on the record and begin with your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Ed King. I'm the Chief Economist for the State of Alaska. Mr. Chairman, I am an economist. I'm only an economist. I'm not a policy person. I didn't build this budget, so questions related to the budget or to policy are better poised for people other than myself. Those people are here in the audience with me. So I'm a numbers guy. I'm going to stick to the numbers. Mr. Chairman, the first thing that I wanted to do in the presentation today, before I even get started, I want to kind of explain to the public and to the members of the committee that when we talk about macroeconomic impacts, what we're talking about is how is the state economy impacted. That is the whole state, not the individuals that live in the state. And there's a difference between the economy doing well and some people in the economy doing worse off and other people in the economy doing better off. From a perspective of macroeconomics, those things might wash, but I don't want to belittle the impacts that are affecting individuals, and I'm not suggesting that those impacts do not occur. I'd also like to say that there's a difference between economic impacts and societal impacts. So the impacts to social well-being is different than the economic impacts. And those things are often confused, especially when we start talking about things like government services, because government services, by their nature, are designed to improve social well-being, which might not be captured in things like GDP. And so there's a lot more information surrounding these conversations than just the economic data, and I think that that's really important to keep in mind. So, Mr. Chairman, if I can tackle the moose in the corner first, a lot of people are talking about the ICER report. ICER can speak for themselves tomorrow, but I am an economics professor, and I do feel inclined to give an economics lecture when I have the opportunity. So the first thing that I wanted to do was talk a little bit about what that report means, how those numbers were created and what they imply and what they don't. And so on slide three, Mr. Chairman, I just put up this illustrative graphic on how a 10x multiplier works. And when we talk about economic impacts, and I won't dwell on this too long, I hope, but the idea that economic impacts occur, it happens not just because of the initial injection into the economy or withdrawal from the economy. That initial injection, whether it's $100 million or $1 billion, whatever that might be, when you put it into the pockets of the people, they go out and they do things with that money. And as they spend that money, then businesses are collecting that money, and that creates additional needs for labor. And so they go out and they hire new people, or they give more hours to their existing staff, and those people then have bigger paychecks, and then they go and take those paychecks to the movie theaters or the restaurants, and then they have the money and they pay it to their wait staff or their employees, and this cycle continues. The money doesn't just get spent once, it flows through the economy. It's a fluid structure, and I think that that's really, really important, because when we talk about economic impacts or an economic impact analysis like what ICER did, what we're talking about is all of the impacts to the economy over all time. We're not talking about what is going to happen tomorrow. We're talking about what are the total impacts. And that might take months or years or decades for those impacts to ripple through the economy. And so when you hear a number like $100 million has a 1,000 job impact, you have to be really careful, because that doesn't mean 1,000 jobs next year. That doesn't mean 1,000 jobs tomorrow. That means 1,000 jobs total. And it could take some time before those effects really do materialize. It's also important to remember that once you stop spending money, then that initial injection goes away, and then all you're left with is those rippling effects. So if you're just talking about an injection of cash, as soon as you stop that injection, the economy is going to contract back to its normal levels, which means that if you want to actually improve the economy in a structural way, that spending has to occur again and again. You're not just talking about $1 billion this year, you're talking about $1 billion every year forever. And if your threshold for whether or not you can make a cut to the budget or a change in government spending is that it can do no harm to the economy, then you'll never be able to stop that spending. Once you put money into a budget, that's gonna have a positive impact. And as soon as you stop putting that money into the budget, it's going to have a negative impact. And there's no way around that. That's just the way that it is. So we have to be really careful when we're talking about how these impacts flow through the economy, because you can never step back down if you're not willing to accept those negative consequences.
I had a question from Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So you're saying that to keep the economy going, we need to keep increasing our budgets higher and higher?
Representative Wilson, through the chair, if you want to maintain the same level of economic activity, you have to maintain the same level of spending. As soon as you reduce that spending, the economy must contract back to its due level.
And follow up?
Follow up.
But if it's the administration's philosophy that we're not just decreasing possibly government spending, but some of that government spending will be picked up by the private sector, then how are we to be able to measure that right now on if it's this segment we do, and I'll use the example a few years ago on DOT when they were going to take the design portion of it and take that to the private sector. Likelihood is that probably would have gotten picked up to some extent, so we wouldn't have necessarily lost a spending, you know, portion of it. But how are we supposed to understand then, from what you just said, the parts that we can that would get picked up, that we wouldn't hurt the economy versus those things that maybe should never have been there and would come out to a different form in the private sector?
Mm-hmm. Through the chair, Representative Wilson, yes, that's a very good point. So that's the other side of the equation. You have to always be thinking about is where is that money coming from and what are the consequences that follow. So if any time that we do these kinds of economic analysis where we say, okay, hold everything else constant and let's just pluck these $1 billion out of the economy and what happens and everything falls apart, that's not how things actually work in the real world. And so when you pull that money out of the economy in one way and you inject it into the economy in another way, whether that's through privatization or whether that's through PFD payments or whether that's through however you inject that money into the economy, reducing taxes, however you might do that, you have to look at all of the impacts in concert. You can't just look at one piece of the equation and say, okay, I understand what this picture looks like.
Follow up. So the analysis that we have been asking for since we began the budget, on this particular budget, we really can't make the informed decision we need to unless we have seen some kind of analysis on the impacts of each and every one of these decreases to the economy.
Representative Wilson, through the chair, I would say, what's your alternative? If I was the decision maker and I was faced with a decision like that and I didn't like the outcome of one option, I would say, well, what are my alternative options and what are the impacts of those? And then you would have to say, okay, how do I compare these options to one another? I understand that the confusion or that the desire is to have a number that we can point to and say, okay, this option creates this consequence. That's an impossible task. You have to also look at what are the other options and what are their impacts and then choose the least bad option. And so the best that you can do in these kinds of circumstances is look at the relative impact of your options and not the actual not the precise number, but what the relative options look like. And ICER did a really good job in their report in laying out what those relative impacts look like. And in their report, it said budget cuts are the least bad option, PFD cuts are the worst option, and taxes fall somewhere in the middle depending on how you structure them.
Mr. Chairman?
Follow up.
I don't know about you, but I don't want to make the least bad option. I want to make an informed decision. Because our other option, I mean, I like you saying that, our option right now, in my opinion, with the time frame that we're in and from we heard from the last speaker, is we might as well just put numbers up all over the room and take a dart and shoot at it and hope that we're right. Because without having that analysis that's been done by the person who has proposed the budget, that's exactly what we're going to do. So if you were in our seat or my seat and you were given a budget, what would be the first things that you would ask to be able to have in front of you so that you can make the right decision based on actual facts?
Representative Wilson, through the chair, I don't want to go too far down this hypothetical. However, I would say that as I would be looking at those proposals, I would say, what are the costs of these services and what are the benefits that they provide, and are we willing to take the money out of the economy in one form in order to provide these services in another? And those are the kinds of analysis that I would think of. I would not be thinking about all of these options have negative consequences, therefore I can't do any of them. That is not an option.
Mr. Chairman, since we have the right people in the audience, if they could do just what he first said and get that information to us about all the decreases they have so we can make an intelligent decision, I think we could have a much better budget cost. So thank you so much for the breakdown, and hopefully we can get that kind of analysis to us.
Thank Okay, we've got questions from Representative Knopp and then Johnston.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. King, so it's an interesting chart you have. So you talk about the one-time injection and the structural shift, and earlier you talked about the social economic impacts versus. So when you talk about a one-time injection, do you create a false economy or do you create a sine wave in the structural shift? So say hypothetically we were doing this quarterly, $1 billion injection quarterly. Do we build our structural shift up then it sinks? Are we creating a vicious cycle and not a so I think the question is, are we doing more harm than good when you do that one-time injection instead of a slow, steady growth thought? Your thoughts on that?
Through the chair, Representative Knopp, the one-time injections are usually things that government does in order to stimulate the economy to kind of get out of a recession. So we've seen those kinds of tax rebates and things like that at the federal level. We don't have very many one-time injections here in the state. The PFD would not be considered a one-time injection because it's recurring. So it is a structural shift, and the economy adjusts to the expectation of that money. Now, it does move every year, so there is some volatility there. But yes, the velocity of money, how quickly the money moves through the economy is one important part of that equation, and how that money gets injected into the economy, whether it's once every month or once every quarter or once every year, or however it might be, those are going to have different impacts on how people evaluate their financial circumstances.
Follow up.
So, and I agree with you. I think the key is how fast the money moves through the market. And since we only do the injection one time a year, I think it moves way too quick. And I think we create that false economy or that wave I'm talking about. I don't think it's healthy personally. And I think, you know, in that sense. So, but I do agree. I think it is at the rate that it moves through the economy is our problem.
Representative Johnston?
Just for establishing time elements here and the ISA report that you have been, referring to, the year that was done, because 2016, and so we have made budget adjustments since 2016, correct?
Representative Johnston, that is correct.
Thank you.
Representative Josephson.
Thank you. Through the chair, Mr. King, the one thing I'm struggling with, and there's some risk that I'm going to lose my train of thought here, but the concern I have here is, you know, I'm remembering January 2016, and the criticism of the previous administration was that with its panoply of taxes on every industry, that there was no production of sort of impacts of all that taxation. And that criticism was, broadly speaking, fair. And I'm making the same criticism, effectively. I don't feel like I'm comparing one unknown to another unknown. I sort of know what a $4.3 billion budget produces in benefits and whether it's, you call it an impact on our treasury, a drain on our treasury, but I don't know what it means to, for example, remove $400 million from the North Slope or have large class sizes that are unprecedented or require local governments to raise their mill rates. I don't know any of that. And so the impact of it has to be viewed warily by me. Ed, do you have any comment or response to that?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, I understand the desire to have numbers, and I think that through the process, you should be asking questions that generate some of those numbers, and the people that have that data should come forward and get that information to you. I know a lot of work is being done right now to evaluate what those impacts look like and how to transition from where we were last year to where the proposal is trying to take us next year. Those are all big pieces of work that take a lot of time. However, I would also point out that if you are going to reject those reductions, you have to ask the question, where does that money come from? Where does the difference between current revenues and what you're proposing to spend, how do you cover that gap? And how you cover that gap is going to have consequences that also need to be evaluated.
And follow up?
Follow up?
I guess the other thing, and it'll come up in later slides, but there doesn't seem to be a much discussion of the broad swath in the middle, that is where there's a sharing of concepts, where there's an appreciation of the value of increasing the dividend, perhaps not increasing it up to its statutory requirement, and not reducing the budget $1.6 billion. In other words, a little less experimentation and a little more sort of a la carte, where we pick a little bit from each category. Is the administration, has it considered that? Because there are obviously infinite possibilities there.
And through the chair, Representative Joseph, I was actually going to use that same phrase. There are infinite number of combinations that get you to a solution. What you have in front of you is one combination that gets to a solution, and that is the solution that the administration moved forward. That is the only solution that we have available to us now to do any analysis on. And as this process proceeds, I hope that we can have those conversations.
Thank you.
Any further questions? Seeing none, Mr. King, please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just have one more point on the slide that I would like to make, and that is this is an injection, and when we talk about an injection into the economy, and as I was saying in the answers to some of those questions, we have to always consider, where is that money coming from? And so if you want these types of impacts, they would have to come from some money that's sitting in the sideline that's being injected into the economy. Then you would see these kinds of impacts. But if you're taking money out of the economy in order to inject it into the economy, you have to look at both of those effects. And so you can't just look at one side of the equation, and you can't build the economy by taking money out of the economy, just like you can't fill up a swimming pool by taking a bucket of water out of it and then pouring it back in. You have to consider all of the effects on net.
Representative LeBon?
I can't help myself. So creating money in an economy, how does the private sector create money in the economy? What's the best way?
Representative LeBon, through the chair. So the economy grows in one of two ways. It either grows through population growth or some sort of resource growth, right? So you're deploying new resources that creates economic growth. Or you increase the productivity and the efficiency of the existing resources. And when I say resources, I'm talking about labor resources, I'm talking about capital resources, I'm talking about natural resources. So those are the only two ways that you can grow an economy. Either it gets bigger because there's more people or more resources, or the people that are there get richer. And so that the way that the economy creates value, and I believe that's what you meant when you said money, is that it takes its entrepreneurship and it finds resources and it combines it with labor and it transforms it into something of higher value that people want. And so that the economy is always finding ways to improve the value of the things that it has. That's how you generate money. The government doesn't have the capacity to generate value. It has the capacity to provide the sideboards for society to work through. It provides the infrastructure for the economy to function. But the government can't actually create value in the way that the private sector can.
And a quick follow-up. And where I was going with this, does the Alaska banking community create money?
Representative LeBon, through the chair, just so that I don't misunderstand the question, are you talking about printing money as though the mint does?
If a bank originates a commercial loan, is that new money into the economy?
Representative LeBon, so the issuance of debt is the transference of future money into the present, if that's what you mean, and that's a form of money creation. The banks don't print money the way that we think of when
that's
we think
correct,
of
they don't.
That's correct, as you know. But I'm not sure that I answered your question.
I guess where I was going with this is the private sector, the banking community is pretty important in Alaska. I spent 42 years in that industry. If a bank originates a new commercial loan to a borrower, it creates the money in the sense that it's new to the economy. It's not pulling it from the public sector or printing it. in the basement. It's creating new money. So a vibrant banking community is really important to the private sector. In my banking days, and this is now a comment more than a question, we didn't have very many loans to government. 99% of our loans were to private sector businesses. And the confidence of those businesses to borrow money in the Alaska economy is paramount to our future and our success as a state. That's a maybe partly a question, but would you agree that a strong private sector is really important?
Mr. Chair, through the chair, Representative Lebon, I do not disagree with that at all.
Thank you.
Just one more talking point on this slide, Mr. Chairman, or on this topic of the ISA report. I put this slide together just to show the proper way of thinking about those impacts that are in the report. And that is, I've heard a tendency for people to look at that report and say, oh, $100 million means 1,000 job losses, or $100 million in taxes means this many job losses, or $100 million in PFD means, you know, this impact. And the temptation is to say, well, I don't like these negative numbers, so I don't want to do any of them. Let's just stick with what we did last year. And that isn't an accurate way of using the report. You need to create a scenario. There is a scenario that's in front of you. That's a governor's proposal. And if you want to increase that spending by $100 million, you have to ask the question, where does that money come from? And so you get those benefits from the additional money that's being spent on government, but there are negative consequences from where that money is coming from, whether that's a tax or whether that's a PFD cut, or whether that's money that's coming out of savings accounts. There are negative consequences related to those options. And so as you're making these comparisons, you can't just look at one side of the equation. You have to look at all of the impacts and see how the net effects look. Just a couple of comments on the ICE report, Mr. Chairman. So the report itself is a fantastic piece of work. I highly respect the authors. I do think that it's unfortunate that some of the material that's in the report is being misunderstood. And I do think that it bears my caution, or my warning, I suppose, to readers of that report, that you need to be careful with the conclusions that you draw from it. And one of those conclusions or one of those talking points tends to be job numbers. And I want to ensure that people understand that when we talk about job numbers, there are different ways that we talk about, as economists talk about jobs. We talk about jobs just as in terms of headcounts, in which case an oil field worker and a part-time cashier at Fred Meyer count as one job each. Those people have different impacts on the economy, though. So maybe calling them equal isn't necessarily the best way of thinking about what those impacts are. Also, we sometimes hear about seasonally adjusted jobs or for full-time equivalent jobs. So it's just we need to make sure that when we're comparing job numbers, that we're consistent in what we're calling a job, and not drawing false conclusions. And then, as I was making in the previous slide, you need to make sure that you're making realistic comparisons. That is, you can't compare spending versus 2019 or PFD payments versus 2019 and think that that is the conclusion. You need to create a scenario that works for fiscal year 20 and then compare that to an alternative scenario that works for fiscal year 20 and see how those compare to one another. Comparing them to last year does not generate the type of information that's valuable. And then, as I said on the very beginning slide, Mr. Chairman, that when we talk about economic impacts, we're talking about impacts over multiple time periods, and so we just need to be careful not to confuse the timing on what those impacts might be. On the second point, that ceteris paribus assumption only holds in a synthetic environment is just a jargon full phrase that translates basically to when you're doing modeling, you force everything to stay constant, and then you pluck the impact out of the model and say, okay, well, what does that do to everybody else? And you do some matrix algebra and you come out with a number. That assumption, though, is a basically a static assumption. It doesn't allow for the participants in the economy to adjust to the changes that are being made in the economy. And it's kind of like, I was at a bar one time, I was standing in front of the fire door, and the bouncer came to me and he said, you need to move, you're a fire hazard. That's a static way of thinking, right? The dynamic way of thinking is, if there's a fire, I'm the first one out the door and I'm not in the way. So we have to be really careful when we're talking about what a computer output generates versus what we would expect to actually happen as the scenario unfolds in the real world. And so even though those impact analyses are relevant and they do generate numbers that are important, they don't necessarily translate to the type of data in what Mr. Robinson was talking about earlier. They don't necessarily translate into the types of impacts that you would expect to see when the numbers come out. So a 10,000 job impact, which might be a projection, might actually only be 100 or a few hundred job impact once you account for all of the actual impacts. That doesn't mean that those 1,000 people weren't impacted, right? Those job losses may have occurred. And those people are definitely impacted. They have to draw down their savings account or their you know, whatever they need to do in order to get through that time in their life is negative and important to them. But from the perspective of the entire economy, as they're adjusting and finding new work and drawing off of savings or making other decisions to replace that income, the static assumption that the model makes that when somebody loses their job, their spending goes to zero, doesn't necessarily reflect what actually happens when a person loses their job. And so the impacts, the outputs of those models that come from that assumption that when somebody loses their job, their spending goes to zero, overstate the indirect impacts that we actually see in the economy. And then, Mr. Chairman, I'll just continue here. A model is a simplification of reality. That's the definition of a model, right? Scaled down version of reality. So it requires simplifications that need to be made. That means that models endeavor to provide insight, not instruction. They won't tell you what to do. They will tell you the relative impacts of your decisions, kind of where to look and how to think about the different options that are in front of you. It will not tell you 2 is greater than 1, so do A. It will not tell you that. But it will tell you that A is a better option than B. It won't tell you the exact number, but it will tell you what the relative impacts, the rankings of those options are. And then as I was saying, there are impacts other than economic impacts that need to be considered. One of those, of course, being the value to society that's generated by the service that's being provided. And that is not necessarily captured in an impact analysis. And it's something that is worthy of conversation. It's not easy to measure. You know, how do you measure whether the value of a road not having a pothole, right? Like there's no way to measure that. We know that one is better than the other, but how do you value that and how do you value how much you're willing to pay for that? And then there is very good information in this report, which I think is very, very valuable, especially those relative rankings between the options that are provided. And the strength of this report, I think, really is in how different options impact different regions and different people. I think there's very valuable insight in this report that I would look to if I were analyzing these proposals. So, Mr. Chairman, turning to the kind of the where we are and why we have a problem that needs to be addressed. This is a slide that represents the difference between revenues and expenditures historically and projecting forward. So this is a graphic that highlights that deficit between revenues and expenditures. And what you can see is that we've had a multi-billion dollar deficit for the last several years. We've filled that deficit through spending, through our savings accounts. As we look forward, those deficits are not going away, but our savings accounts are. And so there is a need to address this issue, and it's not a one-year issue that we just need to get through. It's a structural issue that needs to be addressed.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Josephson.
Thank you. Through the chair, Mr. King, doesn't this slide not reflect the drawdown from the POMV?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, that is correct. This is your revenues that are generated from state activities, not including draws from savings accounts. So you can fill, we did fill these deficits for the last 4 years through draws to the CBR. Future draws from the ERA will offset some of this deficit, but they are still draws from savings.
A follow-up? They're sustainable draws from savings under a structured model. Am I not right about that?
Representative Josephson, yes, they are, but they are not revenues generated from the unrestricted general fund. They are transfers from the earnings reserve to the general fund. So it does help solve the deficit problem, but they are still transfers. And I actually address this in the next slide if we want to move forward. But the point being that the difference between revenues and expenditures is how much money is the state collecting through its state activities versus how much does it need to spend to provide the level of service. And that's what this reflects.
I guess I'm just confused in that everyone understood that that the need for the structured draw was because of a lack of revenue. I mean, it sort of was went without saying that it was designed to fill, hopefully in perpetuity, this gap in our revenue. And partly a reflection of a lack of political will to raise other revenue. Isn't that right?
Representative Josephson, through the chair, yes, that is correct. That is what is happening with that bill, is that you're allowing yourself transfers from the earnings reserve to fill that deficit. That is exactly what we're doing. And it is, you know, because of the way that the earnings reserve generates revenues and that you've allowed yourself to spend some of those revenues for the purpose of the general fund rather than for the growth of the permanent fund or for the payment of dividends, that was a conscious decision that the legislature made, but it doesn't change the fact that it's a draw from a savings account.
Okay. Thank you.
Can we continue? Oh, wait, Representative Knopp.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Okay, Mr. King, you kind of opened the door there. So you call it a draw. Call it a draw from savings, but you don't call it an additional revenue source. I mean, we've historically, over time, people put away $1 million, draw 4% on it in retirement, and live on it forever. It's, I mean, it could be a draw from savings, but it can also be a revenue source. So I find it interesting you keep calling it a draw from savings and not a new form of revenue, even sustainable under a structured draw. So I think that may be where Representative Josephson was going with that. So I think my question is, why are we not considering it a different form of revenue?
Representative Knopf, through the chair. So the money that's spent out of the earnings reserve doesn't impact the problem any different than spending money out of the CBR. It's still a draw from activity that isn't generated by the state. It's not from taxes, it's not from royalties, it's not from anything that the state is doing. So the revenues that are generated from the permanent fund belong to the permanent fund, and the fact that the legislature gave itself permission to use some of those funds for the general fund doesn't change the fact that they were generated from the permanent fund.
Follow up.
So would you not argue, although it may not be revenue from things the state is currently doing, but it is revenue from things that the state has done in the past, historically, for the last 40 years. So,
Representative Knopf, through the chair, I don't argue that those are revenues. I would argue that they are not general fund revenues in the sense that other general fund revenues are.
You may continue.
Madam Chair, the next slide, slide 8, is a reference, is intended to further that point where that structural deficit exists. This is the fiscal year 19 10-year plan for the expenditure side. Those are the red bars. And then the green bars represent the revenue that is expected to occur over the next 10 years. So the very bottom green layer is oil revenue, then the middle layer is non-oil revenue, and then the top layer is the allowable draw from the ERA after you pay out the dividends. And so what you can see is that even with the allowed draw from the POMV, if you follow the PFD statute, there's still a $1.6 billion deficit that needs to be filled in some form or fashion in fiscal year 20, and that problem doesn't go away by itself.
Representative Sullivan Leonard.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to ask the OMB director to come up and just thank you, Mr. King. I appreciate your perspective. If the OMB director would not mind, Director Ardoin, thank you. I'm looking at the takeaway here, ma'am, and it says we have a structural fiscal problem, not a temporary budget problem. I'd like to have that maybe described a little bit more in detail, especially in relation to this graph that we have before us.
Please put your name on the record and help Representative Sullivan Leonard with her question.
Thank you, Donna Ardoin, Director of Office of Management and Budget. Trying to understand the question because I think what Mr. King has outlined here is actually from previous 10-year plan, which shows a mismatch between revenues and expenditures, including the draw from the ERA.
Follow up?
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. I guess I'm just trying to get at how you profess this 10-year forward-looking piece. How did you develop then this particular look at, with it being, a structural fiscal problem? Can you describe that a little bit more, please?
I'm sorry, through the chair. Representative, are you asking what the sources of all of these,
sure,
this data is? I'm going to ask Mr. King to answer that.
For the record, Ed King again. And through the chair, Representative Sullivan Leonard, the numbers here, the red bars here, represent the last year's 10-year plan. That's the path, the trajectory that we're on if we don't make a change. And so when you look at the 10-year plan for the governor's budget, which you'll see maybe next week, you'll see that it aligns revenues with expenditures.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Josephson.
Thank you. Through the chair. Mr. King, you're right that it reflects, I mean, I'm sort of repeating myself, but it reflects what will happen if we don't make a change. But again, it doesn't consider any other sort of reform, taxation, any other sort of revenue, a more modest dividend. It's purely status quo, and in that respect, it's not especially, and I don't mean this disrespectfully, but it's not especially creative in terms of problem solving, is it?
Through the chair, Representative Justin, I didn't intend for this to be a creative slide. This is actually just it's intended to just communicate the fact that there is a problem and that that problem needs a solution and that that problem doesn't go away on its own. So it's not intended to offer up any kind of solution to the problem. There is a gap. That gap needs to be filled. There are multiple ways that you can fill that gap. You can cut the dividend. You can cut the budget. You can raise taxes. You can draw more on savings or any combination thereof. But the point of this slide is simply to illustrate that that problem doesn't solve itself.
Thank you.
And I believe everybody at the table already understands that. So I think we're looking forward to your analyzing what the budget before us does to the economy.
So turning to slide 9, Madam Chair, as I was just saying, there are multiple options, and all of those options have consequences. It doesn't matter how you solve the problem, there is going to be a negative consequence associated with it. And so if the standard for passing a budget is to do no harm, I am sorry to inform you that option is off the table. If you do reduce government spending, you will have job losses, and you will have a reduced level of services. If you raise taxes, that's going to have negative consequences to the economy in the near term and on its ability to grow. And people that have lower household income are going to have a lower standard of banking. If you cut the PFD to solve the problem, then you're impacting different people. That's a more regressive form of the previous, and it has the same impacts. You're going to have people that aren't spending that money that otherwise would, and you're going to have a lower standard of living as a consequence. Or you could just continue to draw off savings. You can go even deeper into the earnings reserve. Doing so is going to have it solves the near-term problem, but it has long-term consequences. And so I just want to reiterate the fact that any solution that we put together needs to address the structural issue that still exists. Even though we've had $3 billion of budget cuts over the last 4 years, the problem hasn't been solved, and it needs to be solved. So, Madam Chair, the next slide, slide 10, is a one scenario. This is if your intent is to not do any budget cuts. So you just take the FY19 budget and you continue to move it forward, and you allow it to grow with the rate of inflation and population, and you have a desire not to raise any taxes. This is kind of how that scenario plays out. Now, obviously, every legislature is going to react differently to the circumstances they're in, so I don't expect that this is how the future would actually unfold, but it does give you insight into the magnitude of the problem and kind of the solution that this scenario would generate. So you could cover the $1.6 billion with PFD cuts this year. That would leave about a $400 or $500 dividend. That, if you want to do that again next year, you're going to have a little bit of budget growth. You're also going to have a little bit of fund growth. So you have maybe a $400 dividend, and then the next year maybe it's a $300 dividend, and eventually you consume all of the POMV through budget growth, and there's nothing left to distribute. And at that point, if the budget still can't be cut and needs to maintain that same level of growth, you need to do something. And if we already took taxes off the table, we took budget cuts off the table, now PFD cuts are off the table because they're gone, your only option is to then dip into savings. That will get you through the next 15 years or so, and then the savings account will go empty. And then that option, that tool goes away, and so now you only have one tool left, and that is to raise taxes. So that's kind of how this unfolds. If you don't make any budget cuts and you push taxes off, this is the world that we would expect to live in, although in reality it would unfold slightly differently.
Representative Johnston.
There's a couple things that come to mind. Thank you to the chair. One is your assumptions for budget growth. What's your rate of inflation?
2.25%.
2.25%, okay. And you're suggesting the status quo is sincerely just a status quo with a population increase of
1%.
What?
1%.
1%. And okay, that's, yeah. All, as you know, is economic, yeah. The other thing that comes to mind as I look at this is I saw a presentation of yours as far as the permanent fund and the earnings of the permanent fund. While I didn't always agree with you on some of your modeling on that one, you were the basic premise was you felt that our permanent fund was growing at such a rate that by taking smaller PFDs now or even taking smaller PFDs or just even taking a discounted PFD, that basically could grow the permanent fund to such an extent that future generations wouldn't have to pay anything.
Representative Johnston, through the chair. Yes, this graphic that's in front of you here is using all of the assumptions that the Permanent Fund Corporation is using. And so this is the drawdown rate at that 6.55% return. And
6.5. So you're going to the top of their stress test.
Representative Johnston, through the chair, no, the middle case for the Permanent Fund Corporation earnings averages on a geometric mean 6.55%.
And this, but our follow-up, excuse me, I should probably leave the room. this modeling is on that, even though the structured draw is on something else, correct?
Representative Johnston, through the chair, so that is a good point. The total fund balance that's generating the POMV is kind of in the background here, and that account is what's earning the 6.55%. The earnings reserve balance is growing at 6.4% because you have some unrealized gains that happen. And if I can address the original question, yes, Representative Johnston, if the permanent fund does a stellar job and beats their forecast, then a lot of these problems become different problems, right? We have the potential. If they earn 10% a year, then we have to start wondering if we're saving too much money. But we, right now, with where we are and what we can see, the best numbers that we have are the numbers that they provide, and this is the scenario under those assumptions.
So, Mr. King, I'm a little confused because I thought this presentation was the economic impact analysis for the governor's proposed fiscal plan. And so far, I don't feel like we are there. I don't think there's anybody at this table doesn't understand that we need a decrease the budget, and I don't believe there's any taxes currently on the table or have been proposed. So is there someplace in the presentation that you're actually going to give us the economic impact of the budget that's before us?
Representative Wilson, Madam Chair, the answer to that question is nobody knows the answer to that question. ICER doesn't know, I don't know, nobody knows exactly how the future is going to unfold. And I wish that I could give you an answer to that question. All of those different proposals are all being evaluated by their own departments and their own staff and local impacts. Those impacts are being assessed by the local communities. All of those impacts are being assessed as we move through this process. But if the expectation is that we know all of the answers before we get started, I'm sorry, but that is not where we are.
This is your presentation.
It is.
And all I'm saying is what we told the committee, that this presentation was going to be about the economics, that this budget was going to present. So I'm not trying to, I just, that's the anticipation I had coming here today, and all I'm asking at this point is most of this that you're giving us, we already know. Is there some place where you're going to help us understand a little bit better what you know the economic impact of the current budget before us will possibly have?
To the chair, Representative Wilson, earlier in the presentation, Mr. King talked about the value of the distributional analysis, the relative ranking of one option versus another. I think that's where he's going with the presentation, where he started, that you have a limited number of options. He's showing you what happens in certain options, where not only you have an economic issue, but you're going to run out of money. Or turn to taxes. But what he was saying earlier, and we'll continue to get through, is that each option has a different weighting. And so, I'm going to ask Mr. King to go back to the beginning where he said some options have more of an economic impact than others. So, for example, I'm going to turn this over to you, budget reductions versus cutting the PFD versus taxes.
With due respect, and we are the House Finance Committee about finance, what we have before us is a proposed budget with $1.1 billion of cuts and about another $600 million of generation of new tax, well, not new taxes, is taking money away from our local communities. So although I appreciate that you're wanting to show us all the other possibilities, what I think we need to hear first is what will this budget do to our economy if we were to pass it as written? Do you have a question, Representative Carpenter?
Madam Chair, I would just like to point out that slide 17 is titled Impact of Proposed Budget. I wonder if that might...
Maybe we should go right there? Let's do that, page 17.
Yes, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Carpenter.
And we can move through these slides. I skipped over a lot of the background there on what kind of generates the conclusion, but I think the biggest takeaway from what I'm trying to tell the public here and the Finance Committee by proxy is that there are these consequences and they need to be compared to something else. They cannot, the conversation cannot simply be can we make this cut or not. It needs to be a broader conversation of if we don't make this cut, then what? And that's really where I'm trying to go with this conversation. And so I can't tell you what this budget impact is going to be because I don't have anything to compare it to.
But Mr. King, it's not our budget. It's the administration budget. And do you work for the administration?
Madam Chair, I do. And again, any time that you're talking about any kind of a relative impact, you have to ask the question compared to what? So if your proposal is different than what the governor's proposal is, then we can talk about what the differential impacts between those proposals look like. But right now, we don't have another proposal from which we can compare it to. It's improper to compare it to what 2019 looked like because that's not a realistic scenario.
So what did you compare it to?
There's nothing to compare it to.
So the administration just put this out with no comparison. Okay, that's fine. Representative Johnston.
I'm going to leave this subject, thank you for the chair, for a minute because I think what will be as helpful or more helpful is when we get the 10-year plan. And you will be working on that, correct?
That's correct.
Thank you.
I'll just flip to you. This this slide, Madam Chair, is just to talk about that the state's budget is always volatile. There's year-to-year changes every year, except for we had a 20-year period where there weren't a lot of changes within the budget. But the point being that the budget that's being proposed isn't necessarily dramatic in the terms of historic volatility of year-to-year budgets. The next slide just talks about how the job market did react to changes in those budgets, and you can see on slide 19, when you compare the expected impact of increased spending, you don't see the corresponding impact in the type of magnitude that the ICER report would suggest, and that again goes back to this idea that those static model outputs don't necessarily translate directly to what real data looks like. And so, I again, when somebody talks about $1 million impact generating $1,000 or 1,000 job losses, that is in the model, that is true. In reality, it doesn't necessarily mean that it is.
If I may?
Josephson.
Thank you. If we could go back one slide. Your note two there says the budget returns the state to 2005 levels of inflation-adjusted spending. Mr. Thiel's equivalent look at this also factored in population growth, and I think his office concluded this would take us somewhere below the 1990s levels, and I'm wondering, and I don't have that. Well, I sort of do in my own graph. I'm just wondering if the population growth would change the 2005 result.
Representative Josephson, the Chair, I'm sure it would. Population growth isn't being considered in that statement, so absolutely. I don't know to what extent. I can't validate the numbers that you just used, but I can definitely take a look at that.
Thank you. And actually, on the next slide, if I might?
Yes, absolutely. Representative Josephson.
On this slide, slide 19, I think what you're trying to show is that that enormous cuts, for example, don't necessarily make jobs crash, nor do increases make jobs grow. But part of the spike that is coming down there in FY13 is capital, most of it. And what ICER apparently reported was that those job impacts are spread over more years and generate half as many jobs per dollar spent compared to cutting the state workforce. So if those were operating budget dollars and not so significantly capital budget dollars, that this analysis could be different, could it not?
Representative Justin, to the Chair, yeah. There is statewide items and capital items within these budgets, just to kind of show the magnitude of when you change the budget, what kind of impact does it have on the jobs market, the labor force. And when you talk about there's the way that you increase the budget or decrease the budget is going to have differential impacts on the economy. And so when you talk about the capital budget exclusively, then those impacts are likely to be smaller than if it's education, for example. But that the point of this slide is to kind of illustrate the magnitude that the economy just simply doesn't react to changes in the time frame that we might expect it to from a static output model. And so those jobs may be, and it's true for any jobs, whether they're capital or otherwise, they're going to be spread over several years. That was the opening slide that I was trying to discuss, that it doesn't necessarily translate into a spike in jobs immediately after the expense or a crash in jobs immediately after the cut.
I mean, my concern with that is that what it tells me is the pain that could be caused to Alaskans will be delayed and not felt immediately, and it doesn't do me much. It doesn't give me any succor. It doesn't help me very much.
Right, and Representative Justin, through the Chair, I empathize. Right, I feel for everybody that loses their jobs. But the point here is that the economy, when we talk about the economy in the holistic sense, doesn't react as a whole in the way that is as dramatic as some of the numbers that I hear thrown around.
Thank you.
You may continue.
The next slide is just, it actually pulls out the capital budget and statewide items and only looks at the operating budget agency operations. It makes an adjustment for inflation and for population growth. And what you see is that changes in the operating budget, the agency operations, don't create jobs. Not in Alaskan history, increasing spending on government programs isn't a job creation endeavor. It does good things. It creates those services that are valuable, but it's not intended to create jobs. If you were trying to create jobs, you would have to go and find people that are sitting on the sideline that don't have a job and then find a way to employ them. So you can buy them a shovel and tell them to dig. And if you want to create even more jobs, you can make them use spoons instead. The point being that when you create government jobs that have programmatic services, you don't do it for the sake of creating jobs, and it doesn't have the effect of creating jobs, because those people within the population that are going to fill those jobs are coming from somewhere. And so you're just moving a job from the private sector to the public sector, and you don't have a net job creation. So the expected job impacts is slide 22, and I think we finally get to the point where you guys want to have the conversation. You'll see that everything is really up in the air. We don't really have an idea. We kind of have a sense of what the magnitudes might look like. State job losses could be anywhere from, you know, in the low hundreds to up to 1,000. It really depends on how things play out with the privatization efforts of the different proposals that are being made. So we kind of have a sense on what that might look like. In education, we know that if the school districts reacted by exclusively laying off teachers, then that number is probably somewhere around 3,000 jobs. But if they do some in finding efficiencies or lowering healthcare costs, or if they reduce heating bills somehow, or aggregate different facilities, or if the local governments pick up a larger portion of that loss, all of those factors are going to mitigate some of those losses. And so it's impossible for us to say exactly what that impact will be. We can kind of look and say, these are the things that we want to look at, and we can kind of understand what drives those different numbers. But in terms of telling you, if you do X, then Y, nobody can tell you that. And anybody that tries to tell you that is being overconfident in their abilities. In the university, it's somewhere, I heard a number that was about 1,300. When I ran the numbers, it was a maximum of about 1,500 jobs, and that is just, again, taking the cut and using it exclusively to lay off faculty and staff, somewhere in that 1,500 job range. But again, if they raise new revenues to offset some of those losses, or if they do other things that create efficiencies, then those job losses will be less. In the healthcare industry, obviously the change to the Medicaid program and that payment structure is going to have an impact on the sector. But that's a really growth sector, so you would expect not for healthcare to lose jobs, but it would have a slower rate of growth. And so there will be, you know, different regional hospitals and medical care providers will be affected differently. But when we step back and look at the whole state, we would expect that the healthcare industry continues to grow, just potentially at a slower rate. And then in the trade sectors, you would expect that the injection from the PFDs would spur some additional spending, and that spending will likely result in some additional labor demand. If you just use the ICER numbers, it's something like 14,000 jobs. I don't think anybody actually believes that that number is what you would actually see. I don't think ICER even believes that that number is what you would actually see. And they can talk about it tomorrow. So it isn't easy to just compare. It's actually not proper to just compare the jobs, because all jobs are not equivalent. You also do have some of those job increases from the trade sectors will be offset by reduced income from people that lose jobs elsewhere. However, their behavioral responses will mitigate some of that that indirect impact as well, because some of them will retire, some of them will draw off a savings account, some of them will find other jobs, some of them will open new businesses. That doesn't mean that losing their job isn't detrimental to them, but it does mean that their spending patterns don't just go to zero and stay there forever. And then at least in theory, we would expect that the removal of the uncertainty on how the state is going to address its fiscal issues will create certainty for investors, and those additional investment dollars should grow the economy. It's not possible for me to tell you how much of an impact that looks like, but we do know that the theory supports that idea, that if you reduce the uncertainty, that more investment would occur.
On that point, through the chair, Mr. King, you know, I can't help but to think of the state of Kansas and Governor Brownback's idea to slash government, reduce taxes. It did not improve fiscal stability. It was sort of a disaster. I mean, that's the conventional wisdom, where the other plain states were doing much better. And in fact, Kansas has turned 180 degrees and run from that model, mm-hmm. and elected a Democrat to the governorship, actually. I'm just saying that that's remarkable that they did that, because it's rare for Kansas. And I'm just wondering why industry would think that this is, partly because we're still linking ourselves more than ever before. Well, I can't say that. It absolutely marries us to the price of oil. Why industry wouldn't be worried about becoming a target of new taxation to help fund what's left of government?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, a couple of comments on that. First, the idea that was floated in Kansas is a little different than the idea that's being talked about here. That is, there was this idea that if you cut taxes, then those savings will be reinvested, and that reinvestment would generate growth. That's not what we're talking about here, because there are no taxes that are being cut. What we are talking about is removing uncertainty about how the state is going to finance its checkbook. And as long as there's uncertainty, then every person that has money that's willing to invest in the state, when they do their economic analysis and they don't know what taxes look like, they can't know what their returns look like. So as long as there's a structural problem, which is why I was talking about the structural problem earlier, as long as that structural problem exists, an investor has to assume that their returns are going to be lower than the current tax rate. The tax rate is going to go up and their returns are going to go down. And so that is a deterrent. Because you don't know what's going to happen, it's a deterrent to invest. And that's true on the North Slope as it is, you know, Target investing in Fairbanks. You know, it doesn't matter who it is or where they're investing. If you don't know how the state's going to generate revenues, you have to assume that if you're successful in your business, that the state's going to take some of that, and that's going to change your economics. So just dealing with that uncertainty should generate some stability, and that stability should generate some increased investment. I don't know to what extent that's true, but the theory supports the idea.
Can I add just to the chair? So the Kansas situation was also a situation where expenditures exceeded revenues. And so they had a mismatch, as we do, in their budget, and also created uncertainty.
Thank you. You may continue.
This is actually the last slide, Madam Chair, and I was talking about just kind of putting a point on some of the earlier points that I was making. The regional impacts to the state are going to be more pronounced than the statewide totals. And so I think a lot of you are more interested in what it does to your constituents and your districts. And when we think about things from the state's perspective, a lot of those negatives in one area and positives in another wash out, and that might not be the way that you individually are viewing these proposals. And that's true at the individual level as well. Every single person is going to be impacted differently. And if we look solely at person that's losing their job, that's an unfortunate circumstance for that person to be in. And if we look at a different option and we take $2,500 out of the pocket or $10,000 out of a family of four's pocket, and that person is low income and now can't afford to do whatever it is that they needed to do with that money, that impact on that individual is important to that individual. And so I think that it's very important to remember that every individual is going to be impacted differently. And when you have, from an economics perspective, if you have a concentrated impact and then a spread out impact elsewhere, those are equal. But in reality, in individual perceptions, it is not. I wouldn't even pretend to say that however we end up dealing with the fiscal issues that it won't result in job losses. Every solution that is available to you will result in job losses, this proposal included. But I don't think that the numbers that I've heard thrown around are accurate in terms of what I would expect the change in employment to look like after this budget was passed. So I would not say that this budget proposal will not have any negatives. It will, but it will also have positives, and you need to look at all of those effects in concert. The numbers that are in the model are those outputs that are generated are static numbers that assume that when a person loses a job, their income goes to zero. In reality, people do other things. That doesn't mean that it's, you know, preferable or good or bad. People are probably want to keep their jobs, and that's not what I'm saying at all. But what I am saying is that assumption that's in those models doesn't necessarily reflect the way that the situation will unfold in reality. So as people retire, and as we, and one of the points that I didn't get to make was that the demographics of the state is such that we have a lot of people that are on the verge of retirement. And during our last recession, that really helped so that we didn't see the types of consequences that we might have expected to see. And as we move forward, some of those same impacts will be mitigated by those same effects. Turning to the next point, household incomes are going to be higher. How Alaskans decide to spend that money is really up to them. Whether that turns into jobs or not is really not the question that the government should be asking. It should be asking, how do we best provide the quality of life for the Alaskans that live here? And giving money to people, by definition, improves their quality of life because they can spend it on something that does improve that quality of life. Taking that money away from it and spending it for them on a service also improves their quality of life, but you need to kind of think about how those two things compare to one another. And then the local government impacts, we don't know exactly how local governments are going to react to the proposals that are in place if they were to pass. We might expect that some local governments raise taxes. We might expect that some local governments make budget cuts. We might expect that some local governments dissolve. And we don't really know how all of that plays out. They might raise other taxes from other from the same industries that the money is being diverted from as well. So we don't know what the local governments are going to do. I know that AML, Alaska Municipal League, is looking at this, and they're much more equipped to have this kind of analysis than I would be able to pretend that I know the particulars of North Pole. I don't, and I would only look at data and not understand by any stretch the impacts on that community as somebody that lives there today and is on the ground, or that you might. So it's much better for those communities that are directly impacted to bring forward what they expect those impacts to be, and for us to look at those impacts and weigh them against what we would expect. So again, that's an analysis that should be done, but hasn't been done by me or our team quite yet, because we don't know how it's going to play out.
Josephson.
Through the chair, Mr. King, I think the most striking thing you said my mind wanders sometimes, is that some local governments might dissolve. Is that what you said?
Representative Josephson, through the chair, I have no idea what the local governments are going to do.
Okay.
But it is an option, and so I would not throw that as something that is not possible, especially a very small community that has, you know, less than 50 people. If they're not getting any state support, then the benefits of being an organized city might not be as lucrative. And I don't know. That's a decision that those local governments would have to make. But I can't tell you how those local governments will react, because I don't sit on those assemblies.
I think the point is made for me. Thank you.
Any other questions? So I just have one. So the takeaway from this presentation we have is that the administration didn't do any kind of economic analysis of this budget and what it was going to be do to the economy of the state of Alaska, correct?
Madam Chair, I would not say that is correct. The administration has been doing analysis on what different options look like, and chose the option that has the least damage to the economy, and that is through budget cuts.
Okay, if we could get those other analyses and what they would actually look like broken down, and why they weren't, that would be very helpful. Any other questions? Seeing none, our next meeting is scheduled for Thursday, March 7th at 1:30 p.m. The committee will hear a presentation again on Alaska's economic outlook from the Institution of Social and Economic Research, and I am definitely looking forward to it. So we will see you tomorrow and at, I'm sorry, 3:50 a.m.